Welcome back to another edition of EdChoice Chats. This is Mike McShane, Director of National Research at EdChoice, and we have a treat on the podcast today. I have the chance to have a conversation with a wonderful, knowledgeable, thoughtful homeschooling researcher. I mean, she's researched other things as well, which should be very clear. But particularly, we're going to spend some day talking about homeschool research. So on the horn, I have Angela Watson, who is a senior research fellow at the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy and assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Education. We're going to be talking about this great new project that she's launched, the Homeschool Hub. But before we get to that, Angela, I wonder if you could just kind of answer a couple big picture questions. And the first would be sort of a personal one in the sense of what got you into homeschooling research? What interested you about it? How did you get started there?
Hi, Mike. Yeah, great. Thank you for having me. Super glad to be here. So I started researching homeschooling in graduate school. I went back to school as a non-traditional student, and I had two small children at the time. But I had always kind of thought about homeschooling. It just never really worked out for us, but it was something that I was interested in. And no one was really researching it at the time. And so I was able to kind of carve out a little niche for myself by doing some homeschooling things, some homeschooling research during those years. But then COVID happened, and suddenly homeschooling got very, very popular. So people started tapping me because I was one of the only people really looking at homeschool research for information on learning pods when the pandemic first happened. And we, you know, now we think back and we're like, oh yeah, I remember learning pods, but that was a whole thing a few years ago. And so, hybrid homeschooling, microschooling, learning pods, homeschooling are all kind of related. And, you know, my work got really popular and I started doing more and more of it. And you know, here we are today.
So when you tell people that you're a homeschooling researcher or when people want to know about homeschooling, I have a question for you, which is, what do you think people get wrong about homeschooling? And maybe we could start with like a lay person, the person you're sitting next to on an airplane and you say, I'm a homeschooling researcher. And they say, well, I always thought X, and whatever X they say is wrong. What is the thing that people get wrong?
Right. So the first thing that people always assume is that I either homeschool or was homeschooled. And so, you know, I don't homeschool. However, I don't think that we would never say that a person who researches public schooling was not eligible to do that work because they public school their kids, right? And so to say that, you know, homeschool researchers can't have homeschooled or they're not adequate or whatever, we're somehow biased, is unfair. When people think about homeschooling or who is participating in homeschooling, the thing they get wrong, you know, is we have this idea of this monolithic group of people who all look the same and are all doing homeschooling for the same reasons. And if that was ever true, which I have doubts that that was ever even true, it certainly is not true today and is becoming less and less true. You know, homeschoolers are very diverse. There are very different kinds of models of homeschooling across the United States, and it's becoming more and more diverse. People from all different walks of life and for all different reasons are participating, especially since COVID.
Totally. And I think that's a really important point that you raise, that there are different ways to homeschool. I think some people have in their mind a particular thing, but like when you use the word homeschool, like what do you mean by that?
Right. So, you know, 10 years ago, if I said homeschooling, everybody knew what that meant, right? There was public schooling, private schooling, and homeschooling, and that was it. And that's not true anymore. And so homeschooling now, when people think of homeschooling, they think of a mom, usually, at the kitchen table at home with her, you know, 2.5 children or whatever, doing the thing. But, you know, people still do that. There are mixed families, you know, where they have families, their neighbors, their cousins, whatever, where they're homeschooling. But now we also have all of these other new innovations that parents have come up with. So we have hybrid homeschools where the students are homeschooled some of the time and they go to a more traditional, maybe brick and mortar setting, or sometimes it's virtual school setting for part of the time. There are also micro schools, which is a little bit more of a traditional, you know, maybe you go to school every day to a school building. But because they're so small and sometimes unaccredited and et cetera, those students are legally classified as homeschoolers in their state. So even though it's not what we would traditionally think of as homeschooling, they are legally classified as homeschoolers, depending on the state. And then you have co-ops that are similar to hybrid school models. People just keep coming up with more and more ways to organize around education. And you know, policy, we have a hard time then deciding which buckets they fit into. And so currently, you know, they either fall into some sort of a private school designation or some sort of homeschool designation.
So you mentioned the pandemic, which obviously, I mean, was such a huge role in education in general, and I think in homeschooling in particular. But I have kind of a research question about it. And it's something that I'm actually, as someone who's sort of tangentially done research on some of these topics, it's something I'm still not 100% clear of, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it. So during the pandemic, the Census Bureau did this pulse survey. And a lot of people who are listening, this is when I think a lot of stuff about homeschooling kind of broke into the national consciousness, not just in education, but even sort of like general news stories you were hearing. It reported these massive jumps in homeschool enrollment. Subsequent research, sort of after the pandemic, the numbers appear to be lower than that. And so there's like a couple ways of thinking about that, which is like one could be that we did just see sort of a spike during the pandemic and then it went down afterwards, sort of a reversion to the mean, even if that, you know, that mean is higher than it was before. It could be that the pulse survey like actually wasn't great and didn't capture what was going on. How should we think about, like, as researchers, how should we think about that survey and what it told us, what its sort of strengths and weaknesses were, what we should take away from it?
So it turns out we are working really hard right now in the research lab, the homeschool research lab, on pulse. So what you said is all true. They started sending out these pulse surveys about once a month, starting in the pandemic, and they have continued to do that. Now, the questions have changed somewhat, but there's still information coming in on homeschoolers. The numbers do seem high. So at the Homeschool Hub, we have state-reported data. And when we compare the state-reported data, so we call them state-registered homeschoolers. So when you look at state-registered homeschoolers and you compare them to the pulse percentages, either from the pandemic or, you know, even today, there's some variation there, like some pretty significant. In some cases, it's like double the amount that the state's reporting are pulse folks that, you know, that are reporting homeschooling. So the problem is that there may be some incentive for the state to underreport. Also, there could be confusion on whether or not you're homeschooling. So I'll give you an example. In Georgia, if you are homeschooling at your kitchen table, right, the stereotypical mom at the kitchen table with her kids, and you are classified as a homeschooler, and that's all fine until your students get older and they want to maybe go to college. And Georgia has a scholarship, but you have to have graduated from an accredited high school. So at that point, that mom at the kitchen table takes her older students and enrolls them in a private school or a private umbrella school. So they're still, you know, doing the exact same thing at the kitchen table, but now they're legally classified in the state as private schoolers, right? And so it's unclear now where those students are counted. You know, I think that they probably disappear from our homeschool count numbers in the state and are now in the private school sector as private school students, even though they're doing the exact same thing, right, that they were doing the year prior. And so I think there's a lot of this kind of thing going on where people identify as homeschoolers on these pulse surveys, but they are not being counted as homeschoolers maybe in their state. And that's why we have some of these discrepancies. So generally what we say and what we think are that these state registered homeschool numbers are the floor. Like those are the lowest possible numbers for participation, and that likely the actual participation is much higher.
So I think it's important, something that you mentioned there is that different states have different reporting requirements, understanding. Could you maybe paint a picture for folks? Homeschooling is regulated quite differently in different states across the country. Could you just kind of paint a picture of what that landscape looks like?
Sure. So in the United States, homeschooling is regulated at the state level, and every single state is different. When we created the hub, I had to read through all of the legislation in all of the states, or all of the regulation requirements for homeschooling, and literally not a single state is the same. So in some states, the family doing the education at the kitchen table is considered a homeschooler. In other states, it is considered non-public education. In other states, it's considered private education. So in California, all homeschoolers or people doing this thing at home at their kitchen table are private schools. So it's, you know, Angela Watson Private School, and my two kids are the enrolled students, right? And so every state is different. And then underneath that, the requirements are for every state are different. So whether they have to be tested, whether they have to learn certain subjects, whether they have to be enrolled hours a day or days a week or months of the year, it all varies state to state. So it's very, very, very confusing policy landscape if you're trying to look at a national view.
And there are, in fact, states where parents don't even have to really tell anybody. Like, they can just do you know about how many states that is, that there's no sort of notification requirement or anything?
So there are about a dozen that have very, very few requirements. You know, Texas, Oklahoma, we know very little about Missouri, and then the I states in the middle of the country, parents, you know, they may have to report. Kansas is a good example. Kansas, you have to report once ever when you first start, and you have to form a school. It's one of the states where it's a private school, but you never have to close your school. So we can see the students come in, but we never see them leave. So, you know, it's unclear how many students we have homeschooling in Kansas because of the way the numbers are counted.
So now we've mentioned the homeschool hub. I feel like I've built up enough anticipation here. We've set the stage. So can you talk about this project? I know it's launching soon. I think we played some role in helping it come to be. But yeah, tell everybody about the homeschool hub.
Yeah. So super great. Thanks to EdChoice. Yes, you guys funded the creation of the hub. I'm really excited about the project. So anytime, one of the main critiques of homeschooling is that there is no rigorous research. And it's kind of a chicken and an egg problem, because there's no rigorous research because it is so difficult to collect the data, and a vast number of other reasons that the research never gets published and doesn't get accepted to conferences and et cetera. But one of the main problems that the hub really is addressing, and a gap that we're really trying to fill, is that what we have done is collected all of this varying information from all 50 states and Washington, D.C., and put it together in one basket where people can come and access all of that information at one time. And so if you are a homeschool parent or some sort of homeschool advocacy or a traditional school district, you know, that is looking for information on students maybe that have left your district and are now homeschooling, or these types of things. Policymakers, we get calls all the time from policymakers wanting to know what the state next door is doing. So all of this information is together in one place. You can come there. You can click through as many states as you want. We also have the data downloadable. So we have 20 years of longitudinal participation data, and you can click a single button and have access to all of that data that we have collected and curated and cleaned for you. And so it should help people access information faster and conduct research much, much easier.
So when you look at that data, the 20 years of longitudinal data, are there any trends that you're seeing?
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. Some of the things that we're noticing in the data that are really interesting. First of all, most of the states will report participation, and that's kind of it. And so it's really helpful if states, many of the states collect other information. They're just not reporting it. Some states do report disaggregated information on, you know, where what the participation looks like by district or by locale, you know, county. city, district. And that's really helpful to us to have a little bit more information about where these students are. Some of the data are disaggregated by age or grade, and that gives us more information on who these new homeschoolers are. So what we saw during the pandemic was this huge increase in homeschooling. From looking at the states where we do have these disaggregated data, we can see that the growth in homeschooling is primarily in younger grades. So this wasn't a huge influx of 11th graders coming into homeschooling. This was a huge influx of first, second, third graders coming into homeschooling during the pandemic. And that's where we see this growth. Without these disaggregated data, that information would not be possible. And so I encourage states to report that kind of information if they're already collecting it. And, you know, only one state in the nation collects and reports information on race. That information is super important because during the pandemic, we saw huge increases. And we know this from the surveys that you were talking about earlier in Black and Brown homeschool participation. But if more states reported on race and ethnicity breakdowns for their homeschool population, we would have more information. So those things are really interesting kind of.
Wait, what state is it?
Delaware. Delaware reports by race.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
So maybe it would be helpful to know, so like of the states and the data that you have, like how many states do you have nothing for? How many states do you have some information for? How many states do you have a ton of information for?
I know that there are about 12 states where we don't have any information or the barest minimum information. So there would be states where they don't report anything, and then we have states like Kansas where they report once and that's it. Most of the states, I think we have good data on about 30 states, and that would be participation data reported from the state. Now, some states, you know, they publicly post it on a, you know, Department of Education website. Other places we have to actually request that data. And so that kind of limits the transparency and the access. And then there are a couple of states where we haven't been able to collect the data, but the Washington Post has been doing a lot of work on homeschooling. They collected a lot of data from places, Kentucky is a good example. Kentucky kindly invited us to go and collect the data district by district. They weren't going to report it for us.
How kind of them.
And of course, you know, we just
how thoughtful.
We just didn't have the resources to do that, but because the Washington Post then did that legwork, they had to have gone then district to district to collect these data. We have, you know, their data that we report on the hub. And, you know, I'm trying to think really good data. I think that we have, like I said, full disaggregated data, only one state, Delaware. We have about a dozen states, maybe nine, where we have some disaggregated information that we could at least look at county. The other one that's really important is family homeschooling participation, right? Oh, we only have two or three states that do that. But that's important because we need to know the number of kids homeschooling, but we also want to know the number of families, because one of the assumptions is that, you know, okay, well, yeah, you have a million, you know, homeschoolers, but really that's only 100,000 families because they all have 10 kids. And what we see in states that we have family information is that does not appear to be the case. And you'll see families moving in and out of homeschooling as well. With both the family information and the grade information, we can see that people do not appear to always be homeschooling these kids, that the kids are moving in and out of homeschooling over time.
That's a really interesting finding. And I think, you know, as I think about the work that you're doing and the kind of broader implications of it, I think one of these, and where I think we see it in other sectors as well, but just the fluidity of kind of student enrollment. I think there was kind of old, you know, you hear like, what was the old metric about, you know, people a generation or two ago would have like one job or two jobs in their entire adult life. And, you know, millennials had two jobs by the time they were 25 or something like that. And we think about, well, okay, that might make us have to rethink how offices are structured, how management works, how compensation works, retirement, whatever, all the way on down the list. And it seems to me like this is kind of coming true in education as well, which is that like any given kid might actually move a couple of times. And I think that there's obviously like very clear like downside risks to that. Right. Like, because moving schools could be can be disruptive and there could be, you know, all sorts of sort of disorganization that happens with that. But I mean, the same was true of jobs, like changing jobs a bunch of times. We thought not that long ago, like, oh, my God, that's totally disruptive. And who would possibly want to get a new job every 2 or 3 years? Now it's like, well, people kind of figured out how to make it. So I'm just curious, just sort of broadly reacting to that, of thinking about this fluidity, thinking about the challenges, but also thinking about the opportunities of it.
Right. So all of the things that you said are true. And then also one of the things that we're kind of seeing is the old, you know, stereotype was that these were two parent families and that usually the woman had to forego employment because she stayed home and educated the children. Right. And so that is like the traditional stereotype. But we're seeing more single parent homes where, you know, because of COVID, because we're able to work, I think we were pushed in a way to work more remotely. You and I are both working remotely right at this moment, right? And so I think that people, single parent households, are now able to consider this option. And, you know, ESAs also are feeding into that as well. As more public funding comes in, there's the possibility that families who were wanting to do this thing and maybe couldn't have afforded to prior now could jump over the line, right, and start participating in homeschooling if they had a little bit more financial support. And so we see some interesting things. I think particularly right now, we see some really interesting things happening with who these homeschoolers are that are different than it was 5 years ago.
So as you look at this project launching and being made available, what is the type of research that you're hoping to come out of this? What questions are you hoping to get answered? What methods are you hoping to get used? What are you hoping will happen?
We're doing some really exciting stuff. So we're working on the Pulse. We're using the Pulse to do what we're calling myth busting, to really look at who these homeschoolers are. And we're going to compare them to average private schoolers, average public schoolers. So one of the metrics we've been working on, there's a question in the Pulse about whether the parent in the household who's answering the survey identifies as LGBTQ. And it turns out that homeschool families are more diverse on that question than private school families, I think, which is a really interesting finding. This doesn't fit with the traditional stereotypes that you hear of who homeschoolers are. So we're working on some of the myth busting stuff. We're also looking at access to special needs services for homeschool families and access more broadly. So in the United States, there's a trend towards homeschool students being able to access some courses, participate in sports, participate in clubs at their local public schools. And this also varies across the country pretty dramatically. But we are seeing a trend towards this. Also, access to special needs services varies radically across the country. So if you're a homeschool family and you have a student with special needs, whether or not that child can get the services that it's supposed to get depends on the state that you live in, the district that you live in, and in some places, it's even determined by the principal at your local public school. And so this is something we're really taking a pretty serious look at right now. We're working on that and trying to get that going because, you know, whether or not it's legal, someone else is going to have to determine, but it certainly doesn't seem right. And, you know, whether or not your kid gets their needs met shouldn't be determined by, you know, what side of the tracks you live on or, you know, what side of the country you live on. So those are some of the main things that we're doing. We're also trying to organize kind of a collaborative of researchers across the country who are doing this work to amplify each other's work and kind of organize so that we can produce more rigorous research, share resources, and also, you know, become more mainstream in academia so that we can get things published and we can get accepted to conferences. Traditionally, it's very difficult to get homeschool research work published and accepted in conferences, which also leads to publishing or broader dissemination. And so, you know, we're trying to kind of put some pressure on the system to start paying a little bit more attention to homeschooling. You know, we're talking about numbers of students that are rivaling the number of students in charter schools. We hear about charter schools all the time. Tons of research conducted on charter schools, and just almost no research or notice or funding dedicated to looking at homeschoolers. And so these are things that we really think need to change as we're going forward in the broader education landscape.
No, that's a great point you just made. And it's a question I should have asked way earlier in all of this when we were sort of setting the stage. To your best estimate, how many people are, like, how many kids are being homeschooled? And maybe if you could explain, like, why that's a challenging number to get to, or maybe it isn't, but I kind of think it is a challenging number to get to. So what do you think that number is, and how did you get to it?
Right. It is a challenging number. Probably the best information that we have is coming from surveys, but the surveys are not perfect either. Then we also have all of this participation data from the states, but we don't have all of the states, so that makes it kind of difficult to estimate, to roll, you know, to aggregate. Best that we have, pre-pandemic, around 2% of students in the United States, K-12 students in the United States, were homeschooled, 2%. Post-pandemic, and mid-pandemic, during the height of the pandemic and then post, the estimates from surveys were around 4.5%. So for all the reasons that I said, we think that those are probably low and that really the participation number is probably closer to 5-6% of U.S. students are participating in homeschooling. And so for comparison, because that also doesn't mean anything to most people, for comparison, around 7% of all U.S. students are in a charter school, and around 9% are privately schooled. So everybody's under 10%, you know, of the total K-12 population of these different choices. And so, you know, these are really, really large numbers of students now. And we need to understand who they are, because currently we're operating off of these old tropes about who homeschoolers are. And we're basing our policies on that. And we need better information, because otherwise we have flawed policy and it's not serving anyone well.
So now, as you look to the future of homeschooling, I sort of just asked about the future of homeschooling research. It might be good to think about the future of sort of homeschooling, the thing that the research is being performed on. Do you see that, let's say we talk 5 years from now, 10 years from now, do we think more students will be homeschooling than are currently? Do we think it'll look different? Was that the jump that we saw during the pandemic, was that sort of just like a stair step from sort of one steady state to a higher steady state? Or did it alter the trajectory of what that line looks like? What do you think homeschooling looks like in the next 5 to 10 years?
So I think it's interesting when we think about the age grade information that we have, we see these younger, that homeschooling growth occurred and is occurring in these younger age ranges. And there are some reasons that could be that parents didn't want their young kids, you know, wearing masks all day or whatever, so they homeschooled them. Another reason could be that younger students have younger parents, and that this generation of younger parents is maybe more receptive to homeschooling. It might not have been stigmatized for them in the way that it was stigmatized when I was growing up. So, you know, they may be less resistant, more welcoming. They also may be more tech savvy. And there are a lot of generative AI and all kinds of online curriculum and programs that these homeschool parents are being supported by. And so it's possible that all of those things are kind of combining to help parents homeschool, but that I think that trend is going to continue. So my guess is that we continue to see more and more education occurring at home. Now, what people call that, I don't know. I think that the name homeschooling is probably going to go away, because, you know, we're doing so many other things. And, you know, I don't know from a policy perspective how we're going to handle defining that and sorting people into these various buckets. But, you know, already we're having issues with that, where we have, you know, micro schools of 100 students who are legally all classified as homeschoolers, and they're not at home. And they're, you know, right. And so it's just kind of a mess right now. And I think, you know, that just has to happen while we're kind of transitioning and moving in new directions. But yeah, I think homeschooling is, the practice of schooling from home is going to increase over time, for sure.
Well, Angela, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the podcast today. Can you let people know, I know the hub hasn't launched yet, where can they find this homeschooling hub of data now? They may have to wait with bated breath for it to appear, but where can they find it?
Yeah, so you can see it now. If you just Google Johns Hopkins Homeschool Hub, it will pop right up. And we have a main page where you can read about it. And then you can, there's an interactive map where you can click on your state of interest and find the data and all of the things. And also information about our research lab that's associated with it.
Fantastic. Well, folks should definitely check that out and all of the wonderful work that y'all are creating. Thanks so much for being on the podcast. Everybody who's listening, thanks so much for listening. And I look forward to chatting with all of you again on the next edition of EdChoice Chats.